Well, we hope by the time we get through with this morning, we won't be picketed. It's a highly controversial subject, but I think that those of philosophic mind should attempt at least to comprehend some of the dimensions of the relationships between partisan politics and partisan religious organizations. We are on the horns of a dilemma at this particular point, because the power of religion was originally vested in a class or caste of highly skilled, highly informed persons. The hierophants of the ancient mysteries in Greece and Rome and Egypt were very well-informed men. They had given their lives to learning, and the temple was also the university. It was the temple that was the cradle of sciences. The priests of the mysteries were astronomers. They were geographers, anatomists, physiologists. They combined their sacred learning with the most profound knowledge available in their time for the general improvement of mankind. Those seeking office, either religious or secular, were initiated into these organizations. And the first and most important requirement was self-discipline. The individual was required to attain a degree of integrity that lifted him above the level of corruption. He was informed on many subjects. There was no division between sacred and secular learning. And those who entered into the temple rites might in later life be emperors, generals, leaders in knowledge and science, or they might be private citizens with unusual abilities. In every case, the information provided gave them a full and solid foundation upon which to develop a philosophy of life. This condition gradually came into conflict with the secular ambitions of persons, most of them either uninitiated or else corrupted even after they had accepted the obligations of the temple. It is therefore very important to realize that when we think in terms of religion, that we understand exactly what it means in its full and most complete sense. Religion was primarily the continuing effort to discover truth. It was concerned not with the attitudes of persons, but with universal principles. The search was for the laws of life, as these revealed the laws of God. Now it is obvious that with such a background, and with such dedications, purifications, and methods of instruction, the religion provided the most dynamic force in the development of civilization. It became not only a leader, but a common denominator of the various levels of human activity. The religions of that time were subsidized by the state. They were part of a traditional inheritance that had descended from an unknown past. The traditions, the cultures, the allegiances, all grouped around these sacred institutions. Of such minds, we have Pythagoras, who probably did more to advance the sciences of music and mathematics than any other recorded atomism by Democritus. We also found among them powerful minds dedicated to the preservation of all available knowledge. These initiated priests were fully aware of the grand scheme of things. They were serving principles primarily, as these principles reveal the will of God. Now, under these conditions, the mysteries flourish for centuries, and to a measure, they have influenced practically every modern world religion. They have contributed to the basic concept of religion, and that is obedience to divine will. This obedience was not primarily sectarian in those days, and the chain of mystery institutions, which spread not only throughout the Mediterranean area and North Africa, but went all the way to India and China, these institutions were compatible. There was no question of whether or not an institution worshiped the true God or a false God. For in this system, all principles preserve conduct, and all wise people recognized and rejoiced in the wisdom of other people. Many of the initiates of Greece were also initiates of Egypt, and some of them went into the Far East. Buddhists and Hindus came to study in Greece, Antioch, and Ephesus. They were a kinship of enlightenment, and because they had a common realization of the principles underlying worship, they were compatible. There was no competition of creeds. There was no division by land or race, by language, or by symbolism, which prevented the one who was initiated into one order from being received as an equal by those of other similar organizations. It therefore is rather obvious that in its ideal state, religion represents a unity of beliefs. It represents a unity based upon integrities. It was an exact science which manifested itself through the development of virtue and morality throughout the world. Now, under such conditions as these, it was quite obvious that kings and princes and rulers were initiated. Also, that they had counselors who were informed in any knowledge which they could not achieve. The Emperor Julian admitted that he was a novice in these matters. He did not understand the full meaning of the great descent of wisdom, but he had been initiated. He recognized the integrities, and he leaned heavily upon the counsels of those better informed than himself. All this situation places religion in an idealistic situation, a situation the importance of which cannot be in any way questioned. But gradually changes took place, and we began to develop a certain separation between church and state. It was no longer the function of leaders to bring their problems to the temple. And in the old days they did so, the judgment they received was suitable to the solution of the secular problems of society. But as time went on, this happy brotherhood faded away, and gradually religion became an isolated area of human thought. It became one institution among institutions. It no longer held the common veneration of all classes of people. As this condition continued, it was obvious that secular considerations began to dominate. As these secular considerations became more numerous, conflicts were inevitable. These secular problems separated from a high philosophy and an inclusive religion became virtually unsolvable. The various kingdoms began to depend upon secular statesmanship. They began to select persons who more or less would advance the personal ambitions of leaders. The counselor began to counsel the king how to enlarge his own domain. He became more or less an aide or an assistant to a secular government. In old times, some of these statesmen were obviously persons of high reputation. They did a very sincere job, but as a result of the continuing break between religion and secular affairs, they lost the control of the minds of the rulers. The rulers began to think their own thoughts. They began to plan their own programs, and it gradually dawned upon them that power, which was being more and more vested in individuals, that this power could be used advantageously to advance the concerns of princes. This type of separation has led gradually to a condition which is being brought strongly into focus by present world affairs. We have a very strong and depressing example in the present situation in Iran. Here we have a country that is coming more and more under a theological political structure. As a result of this, we find what we might term fundamentalism, the fundamentalism of the Muslim world, taking precedence over the well-being of the people and the advancement and progress of the country. We know beyond question that such a program cannot endure indefinitely. A small island of orthodoxy cannot continue to exist in a world which is no longer under the domination of such orthodox concepts. Now, there are many points in the Muslim religion which are highly desirable. In substance and essence, it is founded upon a combination of Judaism and Christianity. Muhammad would turn in his grave at the present situation. And yet gradually the rising power of the caliphate has resulted in the submergence of the concepts of Muhammad and the development of the high personal ambitions of political leadership. We therefore now find that the general condition of society is being damaged by what might be termed theological orthodoxy. Orthodoxy which is not based upon either the Bible nor the Quran, but is really up to opportunism, the ability of political leadership veiling itself under religious cloak, attempting to regain its authority in the development, scientific, industrial, economic, and cultural of a modern people. Now, the situation is an exaggerated one, and we believed and hoped that long ago this type of attitude had vanished from the earth, but it has not, and it continues to be a very serious matter. Now, what is thus essentially wrong with the interpretation that modern Iran has given to to the teachings of Muhammad. It has allowed them to fall into the hands of individuals who were not actually religiously oriented. They had religious estate and dignity, but as persons, they were not living it. They were rather engaged in a vengeance campaign against other people, as was indicated by the situation of the present hostages. This situation, politically, may be justified on several counts, but in terms of religion, it cannot be justified. It cannot be justified with the concept that two wrongs make a right. Nor can it be justified by the Sermon on the Mount, in which the individual is reminded that to forgive, to pardon, to have mercy, these are great religious virtues. Now, we also find in this particular situation the failure of Muslim leadership as a religion. It is not in a position to actually adjust its own doctrines to protect, lead, direct, enlighten, and clarify the situation of its policies. This situation is what has threatened the world on a number of occasions, and will continue to do so until religion itself clarifies its own position and accepts a dedication above all, might say, partisanism on any level. When the disciples began to hope that Jesus was going to finally take back the kingdom of Judea from Rome, the Master said very simply, "My kingdom is not of this world." The kingdom of religion is not of this world. The kingdom of religion is a kingdom of spiritual value. It is not a plaything of policy. It is not something that is to be adapted to the conveniences of selfishness or personal ambitions. The important thing for the last 100 years especially is that religion must restore its essential purpose and dignity. It must begin by doing that which it would demand secular institutions to accomplish, namely, achieve its own internal unity. There is very little difference between political parties and religious denominations. They are in conflict, they are in competition, they are seeking to dominate their various spheres of influence, and they have no actually common ground. There is a theoretical common ground. We know that the Ten Commandments exist in practically every religion of the world. We know that to do unto others as we would have others do unto us has been translated into the religious codes of over 50 different beliefs. These common grounds, however, are not practiced. In actual relationships with the problems of living, the identities of religion are compromised. We are still in need of a religious cooperative, a league of nations in religion, rather than a league of notions. To achieve this, religion must put its own house in order. It is not important or necessary. The different religions should give up their beliefs and meet in some sectarian group or a group made up of sectarianisms. Its primary purpose is to restate itself on the essential reason for the existence of religion in the life of man. All religions should be on good terms with each other. They should respect and accept differences of theology as they accept differences of race or differences of color or difficulties of language. But there is no reason why religion should not be a unity, a common strength, indivisible, and have as its primary purpose the advancement of all constructive and useful knowledge, physical, moral, ethical, spiritual. This is the first task. This is the challenge. Until religion is able to put its own house in order, it is going to have great difficulty in attempting to govern or direct secular activities. Until religion itself is recognized for what it is, the will of God revealed through natural law to all mankind. This recognition then begins to make a change in the structure of our theology. Today, most religious leaders, I assume to be sincere, I believe they are doing what they believe to be right for the good of man and the glory of God. But these different leaders have lacked the background experience which was part of the education of the temple mysteries of antiquity. The average religious leader is not a statesman. He is a theologian. He is not a scientist. In fact, he is often in conflict with science. He is not a highly trained philosopher who has found the depths within himself as the basis of an over-realization of responsibilities. He is actually a person tied into the structure of a belief and believes that the highest moral duty is to sustain that belief, to protect it, to serve it. Now, the beliefs themselves are not necessarily wrong. There are many of them very beautiful and very noble. And that religion is making a contribution to common good cannot be and should not be denied. It is doing a considerable amount of work. But this considerable amount of work is largely compromised by ineptitudes. The individual who is an evangelist today is not comparable to the initiate priest of antiquity. He is not a person who is able to see and appreciate truth outside of his own denomination. He is not able to work for a strong reconciliation between beliefs. His idea of reconciliation is that all others should join his belief. This situation is not very helpful in terms of modern policy. We have, on the one hand, therefore, a well-intentioned theology that wants to be helpful, but to do its full job must be completely reconstructed so that educationally everyone who comes out of a seminary is a deep, broad, wise, and practical thinker. Not only acquainted with the principles of his sect, but fully acquainted with the needs of mankind and with this equipped skills to serve those needs intelligently. It is not a devotion alone that is going to solve our problem. It must be solved by an intelligent devotion, a devotion which transcends most of the limitations which have separated creeds for thousands of years. After coming to a practical and proper conclusion, having the skills of the statesman and the ideals of the priest, and these are brought together in lives dedicated to common service, we would have a far better chance of meeting all of our problems, both those which are spiritual and those which are secular. Now, as the religious world is so divided, so is the secular. And at the present time, the United Nations organization reveals the conflicts that arise in the administrations of government. Now, why do these conflicts exist? They exist because the average leader in the secular field is not a philosopher. He is not a deep thinker. He is an individual who has had very specialized training, perhaps in business, perhaps in law, or whatever his background may be. But he is not a person who is able to instinctively and inevitably make a discovery that was given to the world thousands of years ago, namely that all human affairs are governed by divine law. Every lawmaker must, to fulfill his purposes, understand the grand plan of life, which he hopes to serve, which he would like to advance. He must, therefore, be a person in whose nature are solutions. Solutions based upon a comprehensive understanding of the condition of the human being. It would be very important for him to be a universally educated individual. And if this is lacking, then whatever specialization he may have given his career to in order to advance his own purposes, this specialization should be under a direct concept of integrities. In other words, the university, which is the modern equivalent, so to say, of the ancient mysteries, but is not a very good equivalent. The universities should also include to all students the grand scheme of life, the essential reasons and purposes. Now, some will say that this cannot be done because these overtones cannot be scientifically diagnosed, that the individual, in order to accept a high integrity, must assume qualities which he does not understand and which may exist only in the minds of those around him. This is essentially not true. There's no area in human education in which the facts of life are not obvious and cannot be demonstrated scientifically. Therefore, the science of integrity is the most important of all sciences and should be at the head of all the curricula that we have today. The whole survival of man, the whole survival of institutions, the security of the individual, the happiness and peace he longs for, all of these are byproducts of integrity. And without that basic value, the world can never escape from its dilemmas. Integrity, therefore, becomes an essential. Now, the average person is not trained in integrities. And under the prevailing system that we have today, integrity is virtually a debility. Integrity is an almost certain source for failure. The individual trying to live according to principles finds that these principles are detrimental in a system in which the integrity is lacking. He might also notice, of course, that this lack of integrity is bringing disaster to all these institutions. But he still does not feel strong enough, wise enough, or perhaps gifted enough to attempt a universal reformation. This was the principle behind the reformation which took place in the early 17th century. with a reorganization of the whole theory of human relationships. This reorganization was based upon one simple point, namely that science, properly understood, properly directed by enlightened minds, is the most powerful aid to religion that exists. It is science that can prove religion. It is science that can take religion out of the clouds and put it to work in the daily life of the individual. Science must, however, first discover the sacredness of its own knowledge. It must recognize that the further it explores into the unknown, the closer it comes to God. And that instead of God being a useful hypothesis, God becomes the ever-present source of every particular that exists in space. Science, so equipped, could be very, very useful, in fact, indispensable to the protection of society in the centuries that lie ahead. But it can only be so when it is restored as it was in antiquity, as part of a universal program of education, which went all the way from biology to music, and went all over that vast distance between psychology and mysticism. These different aspects of one great reality have not been brought together. And until they are brought together and harmonized, this mysterious elixir of life that we hope for cannot be produced. Now, on the opposite side of our problem, we have trained statesmen and untrained statesmen. The degree of their training is more or less secondary. The main problem always is, what is the person himself? Is he, by nature, upright? Is he doing the very best he knows? And does he know enough to do something that is best? If he has the knowledge, has he the character to defend his principles against the inconsistency of his associates? This is a problem that we also face, but we are a little bit in the condition of the blind leading the blind, and everything is falling into the ditch together. To meet this type of problem, many very thoughtful persons feel deeply involved, and many individuals who will never have a word to say in the government of things have ideas that would be intensely useful if they could be brought to the attention of the right persons. The right persons, however, today are locked within patterns. They're held within allegiances. And just as the theologian is bound to the rules of his church, so the politician is bound to the rules of his party. They are both in the same difficulty. And until one or other solves the difficulty, progress cannot be guaranteed. Up to that time, we must do the best we can. On the grounds of the remark or words of Jesus, that his kingdom is not of this world, then where is this kingdom? Where are we going to find it? If it is not in society, if it is not in operation anywhere in the current world of events, where shall we look for it? The kingdom of Jesus, the heavenly world, is a spiritual phenomenon. This is part of the spirit of man. It is part of the soul of man. And the great throne of spiritual integrities is within man himself. It is no longer possible to deny the individual the right to grow. But it is not inevitable that this right will be challenged. And even if it is challenged, it is not certain that the individual will accept the challenge. Because of the inconveniences of integrity, many persons are allowing their own lives to run contrary to a constructive destiny. Actually, we have in the world today somewhat over 3 billion human beings who are essentially committed to religion. The religions are different, but they are all always the same in one circumstance, that they are the guides to the inner life of persons. They are the rock which we depend upon in emergencies. When worldly conditions fail, the individual has no source of strength but his own inner life. And this inner life supports him by revealing to him the integrities by which survival is possible. So we have a kind of institution composed of 2/3 of the population of the earth. And this institution has always had the same essential teaching. It has always emphasized personal value. It has emphasized morality and ethics. It has taught us most of the useful rules of life, which we have continuously discounted or ignored. These rules tell us that the only end to conflict is the realization of the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man. Now, the fatherhood of God does not seem to give us too much trouble, but the brotherhood of man is really in frightful condition. It has been broken up until our brothers are only those who agree with us. Our brothers are those who contribute to our personal success in one way or another. Our brothers are those whom we can depend upon when our needs are great. But we are not at all sure that our brother is not going to charge us 18% interest when we need something from him. Consequently, while we live in a world which is filled with churches, mosques, synagogues, pagodas, dagobas, we are living in a secular world. A world in which spiritual values no longer lead the collective conduct of society. Under such emergencies, we all realize that we are also temporary citizens of this earth. This small globe we call the world is really merely a guest house along the great caravansary of cosmic motion. We are here for a time. We are citizens of the nations to which we belong for a few years, perhaps to be stretched to a century by scientific skills. But we are always citizens of eternity. The divine world, which reaches out beyond the furthest star, the divine laws which govern the motions of galaxies, these are the fundamentals. And when we leave this mortal sphere, we are again part of the vast project of existence. We are to go on to unfold those values which are indispensable to universal citizenship. It would be very convenient, helpful, and inspiring if this universal citizenship could at least in its beginning bind the parts of our earth together. If we are citizens of the universe, we are also citizens of the smaller world, which is our temporary habitation. And it is very much in order to begin the simple but direct process of binding up the wounds which are the cause of the present tragedies. We have been short-sighted, self-centered, and overly ambitious. and not one of these is a spiritual grace. We have overlooked entirely the fundamental realities of life. Yet we see these realities around us every day. We live not in a man-made world, but in a universal pattern. And we have tried to obscure that pattern by our own audacity. We have tried to assume that we were lords of all we survey, and that it was our destiny to create a system to our own pleasure. We are already finding it very unpleasing. We must sometime go back to facts, because facts alone are our salvation. Now, whether we should be involved in party politics at this particular time will probably be viewed differently by different persons. If we were sure of certain values and knew how to apply these values, if we knew whom we could trust, who would do the things that are necessary, we could advance with greater confidence. Our only source of information available through the media of our time is the record of the candidates themselves. What they have done, what they have stood for, what they have opposed, what they have defended, these are the basis upon which the average person must make his judgment. Now, at this time, there are a great many disillusioned persons, and it was noted in the press not long ago that there might be a very large number of American citizens who would not vote at all, because they did not have confidence in any of the candidates. This is too bad. But it is also a point which must be given a lot of consideration by those who want to make a decision of some kind between the available possibilities. Each must use his own integrities, his own ideals, and his own principles in order to accomplish this particular end. Confucius, in his study of society, made a very interesting ladder leading upward through the stratas of social structure. The foot of this ladder was founded upon the foundation of the home, the most immediate and valuable unit in society. The little democracy or autocracy, according to how it is managed, is the home, which is gradually becoming more or less a ground of activism. The home is the first problem that the individual must solve. According to Confucius, when the home is a proven success, it may be assumed that the members of it have intelligence enough to go higher in their thinking. If the home can be protected, if it can be preserved against the pressures of a decadent system, we have a unit, the first world that we can rule, the first institution, the primary unit of society. This is the fabric upon which all the rest is built. This is the atom which combines to complete the social structure. So if we have principles, if we have integrities, if we have ideals, dreams, and visions, the home is the laboratory for their application. Here we have a right to see, to observe, to study, to reflect, and to discover those principles and convictions which are most likely to preserve not only the outer form of the home, but its inner structure, which is the home itself.
It is the inner structure that is the real family. Now, we have also a family of nations. But in all practical purposes, the family of nations is an aggregate of homes.